Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. Alfred Adesk and James Corbett of the Corbett Report will be joining you in the program for the second and third segment today. And just a reminder, James Corbett is also, you can go to his website. He does the Corbett Report, and he is also the lead writer for the International Forecaster. So it's always great to have him join us every Thursday, and I so do appreciate it with him being in Japan. Certainly the time differences always makes it difficult for him, we were a little concerned with the earthquakes, but he was able to do the program. And today is Thursday, April 21st, 2016. I have to apologize for my scratchy throat. I think it's just allergy season. High winds have just really been wreaking havoc on my throat. So you're just going to have to listen to a little bit of gruffness today, I suppose. But anyway, gold today was up 570. $1,251. It's interesting because when markets opened this morning, we had a high of 1,271. It was up over, $20, $23. And it reversed itself. ECB President Mario Draghi came out, and we'll talk about that right after the market report briefly. But so you had a big reversal in gold today. But it was still up 570. We'll take it, 1251. Silver saw the same thing. Silver was up 0.06 at 1710. Platinum was up 8 at 1030. Palladium up 10 at 608. USDX today was trading, it was weak all day long. And now we're showing that it's up 0.02 at 94.59. Crude oil was down 72 at 43.46. Some pressure on the markets. When I think of pressure on the markets, I'm talking about 500, 800 points drop. 113 point to the downside. To me, it's really no big deal. 17,982. If you have multiple days of 113, it begins to show a trend. Yeah, and then you can, take some warning. But the NASDAQ was down 2, 49.45, and the S&P down 10, 2,091. Again, what I find interesting is how the yields are working on the 10-year is moving up once again at 1.87%, up 0.02. They're trying to hold the euro at 113. That was down a little bit, 0.10, still at 113. And there was pressure on China's Shanghai Composite Index. That slid another 0.7%. And they want to claim that George Soros, after his comment on Wednesday that China's debt-fueled growth resembles the U.S. in 2007-2008, put pressure on their markets. And but he's viewing China's problems the same as the U.S. Before all the credit markets seized up and, of course, spurred a global recession, which is interesting because everybody come January, in the middle of February, thought we were heading back into a recession, into the recession that we never came out of, but in government's terms. But hey, you know, what a difference a day makes, you know, when central bankers get together and stoke the markets, and we had this incredible recovery, and now no one even whispers the word recession. And but what has changed? What really changed from mid-February to today? Absolutely nothing. The only change was you had the stocks go up back to 18,000. And you can blame that on a lot of things. And we know it's not true fundamentals. So again, it's just a paper market. Folks, you need to protect yourself. Get out of that paper, protect it, insure it, and get into some gold and silver. ECB President Draghi, he said interest rates will remain at present or lower levels for an extended period of time. And he calls on critics, you know, to give the banks, stimulus program time to work. He thinks, you know, markets just haven't given enough time to the stimulus. And I believe he's going to need lots of time, you know, because these, you know, they're doing the same thing that the U.S. did, continues to do, desperate measures for desperate times. And again, what has changed to improve world conditions? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Today, Verizon reported, got some of the blame for some of the markets being down. And despite making $39 billion profit over the last 3 years at a $4.3 billion in the first quarter of 2016 alone. Now, I'm talking about the strike that they're having with their employees. Then we'll talk a little bit about the numbers, very little on the numbers. But they reported today. They came out, and the reason I'm bringing it up this way, they reported today. They're making money, $39 billion over the last 3 years, $4.43 billion in the first quarter of 2016 alone. So their numbers are good, and the company is still refusing to settle a contract, a fair contract, with its own employees. And they're going to continue to offshore jobs to the Philippines, Mexico, and other locations. So, you know, the people, the employees have a hard time after the company makes this type of a profit. You know, the CEO gets $18 million in compensation last year. So they just want to make sure they have a little bit more security for their jobs, to not ship them offshore. But also what they're looking for is better health care. And I think the big one they mentioned is pensions. And I find this interesting because you're right. You think that with a company making this type of profit, you know, that they would want to try and settle something. 40,000 folks is a lot of folks. However, I wonder, is it possible that Verizon is waiting for the Treasury Department to announce a crucial decision? And I believe this decision is coming, it's expected sometime in May, I think it's about the middle of May, on whether it will approve reductions to one of the country's largest multi-employer pension plans. So they changed the law in 2014. The potential cuts are possible under this legislation that was passed in Congress in 2014 that for the first time allowed financially distressed multi-employer plans to reduce benefits for its retirees. If it would prove if it would improve the solvency of the fund. Now, this law weakened federal protections that have been on for, what, more than 40 years? That has sort of shielded the worker so that they could rely on a financial security in their retirement. So now we got to take that away. There's no more security in retirement. There's no more security in your pension plans. So this law was passed. It was initiated and passed in Congress in 2014. So now you have one of the largest pension plans that has submitted the documents last year to see if the Treasury Department will allow them to reduce their pension plan. If it gets approved, I'll guarantee you, you might see Verizon doing the same thing, calling their plan, their pension plan, insolvent, sending the paperwork to the Treasury. The Treasury is going to go ahead and probably, rubber stamp it with no problems whatsoever. And then they'll make the agreement with their strikers, with their workers that are striking. Don't know. I mean, the middle of May is not that far away, but when you have 40,000 employees striking, they might come to some sort of an agreement prior to then. But it's just my thoughts, just interesting. But I guess if the Treasury does pass this for this with the country's largest pension plan, that will go into effect come July for those folks. So again, you have to take control. And they're going to strip until somebody says enough or until there's just nothing left anymore. So not a good sign for the system. And here's some interesting statistics from CNS News, CNS News, a Terrence Jeffrey. And it really is, again, it just puts things into perspective. The United States, this is the 10th straight year without 3% growth in real gross domestic product. And I was just watching CNBC prior to the program as I was getting the final numbers to see if there's anything exciting going on. And they were reporting these same numbers, but they said 8 straight years. The truth, 10 straight years without 3% growth in GDP. And this data was released by the Bureau of Economic Analysis. The Bureau of Economic Analysis has calculated GDP for each year going all the way back to 1929. And it has calculated the inflation-adjusted annual change in GDP from 1930 and forward. So in 85 years for which BEA, Bureau of Economic Analysis, has calculated the annual change in real GDP, there is only one 10-year stretch. And I'll guarantee each and every one of you can know what years they were. 2006 through 2015, when the annual growth in real GDP never hit 3%. And during those last 10 years, real annual growth in GDP peaked in 2006 at 2.7%. It has never been that high again. In the 6 full calendar years since 2009, it has never exceeded the 2.5% that it was hit in 2010. So you tell me how things are getting better. The average growth rate for economic recovery since the 60s is 3.9%, ranking the Obama recovery with an average growth rate of just 2.1%. And this is among the slowest in history. Before this time, the longest stretch of years where it did not grow by at least 3.0% was the 4-year stretch. And I'll guarantee you, each and every one of you can pick this 4-year stretch. Was between 1930 and 1933. And we all know what happened in 1933. So in addition to that four-year stretch, I know these are a lot of numbers and they seem to be can be confusing because I know it's radio and you don't get to follow along with the numbers. But in addition to that four stretch from 1930 to 1933, there have also been 4 3-year stretches where the growth did not go as high as 3%. And you can probably guess these too. Those periods were 1945 to 47 in the immediate aftermath of World War II. We have the 56, 58, 80, 82, 2001, and 2003. So again, these are each of the recessions. And again, if you go back to the 1980, 1982, I mean, we see how much debt has been created after that. I don't believe we ever came out of any of those recessions. They have just been covered up by an incredible amount of debt. The longest consecutive stretch of years in which the U.S. saw real GDP grow by 3% or better was a 7-year period during the presidency of Ronald Reagan. So, again, I thought that was sort of interesting. In the annual report of the Economic Council of Economic Advisors that President Obama sent to Congress this week, the administration noted that it is projecting real GDP growth by only 2.7% this year, and by less than that in the following 2 years. So, you know, as good as he says everything is, we're still not up to those numbers. And in the next 2 years, it doesn't seem like things are going to be improving or even staying the same. It's going to be less than what this year is. So, hey, this is a peak year, folks. And so, you know, appreciate it because things, I believe, are going to get incredibly worse incredibly soon. And I believe we're going to start seeing the markets unwind once again come June, if it lasts that long, through the summer. This is an election year. And it's a very interesting election year, and anything can happen at any time. Usually during election years, they do try to keep things a little bit quiet, but this election is not quiet. So they certainly have taken the focus off the economy, and so since the first of the year, and the big distractions have been the election. So if things go as I believe they will, I think by August. And we saw the same thing last year. Last year, I said we're going to start see softening in the numbers and so forth come June, July, and August. And that's exactly what we saw. We had some more big bankruptcies. Sun Edison liabilities of $16.1 billion makes the world's biggest renewable energy developer the biggest bankruptcy of 2016. And we thought Peabody, that reported on April 13th, a week ago, that they were going to be the biggest bankruptcy. Well, they were beaten by Sun Edison. Peabody Energy was $10.1 billion on April 13th. Now we're looking at $16.1 billion for Sun Edison's liabilities for the biggest bankruptcy of 2016. So again, these are just another 2x4s in the breeze showing you that things are not going to get better. I look for good news, really don't see any. And there's more and more layoffs are coming. We talked about Intel earlier this week. Sport Chalet, a big retail store in Southern California, they announced they're closing all 30 stores. They're closing their online orders. They went public in 1992. GM global sales fell 2.5%. They had a little bit better response in the U.S. Of course, we know there's subprime lending in the U.S. They beat the street. But what's interesting is the average GM vehicle sold or leased in the U.S. during the quarter was priced at $34,000, about $3,000 more than the industry average. So, you know, prices continue to rise, wages stagnant, and less jobs are coming our way. 1-800-375-4188. It's 1-800-375-4188. We got some great specials today on gold and silver. Pick them up at some very great prices, low premiums, and very fast shipping here at Discount Gold and Silver. Alfred, James Corbett will be joining you right after this very short break.
Financial obligations or relationship problems have you feeling stressed out? When life is too much to handle, use Apothecary Herbs' emotional stress formula. Feel calm and more in control with herbs especially combined to provide the organic nutrition your system needs to help you cope. Complete instructions for maximum benefit and a money-back guarantee. You've waited long enough. Call Apothecary Herbs now. Toll free 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver, 1-800-375-4188. Our guest is James Corbett, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, from thecorbettreport.com. Also, you can catch his videos, podcasts. James is just about everywhere except for ABC, CBS, and NBC so far, and maybe he's even there for all I know. Hello, James. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. I'm not on any of the big alphabet soup networks, but WNYC, the radio station, just recently did a little hit piece that included a bit on my Panama Papers video, trying to talk about, oh, those crazy conspiracy theorists have crazy conspiracy theories about the Panama Papers.
Mm-hmm. You've had kind of an earth-shaking week, if I understand correctly.
I have in general.
You're
on
the southern end of Japan, if I understand correctly, which was more or less where the earthquakes hit in the last couple of days. Is that true?
I guess it depends how you say southern and Western and what those terms really mean. Yes, well, we're hundreds of miles away from Kyushu, where the quakes were happening, and on a completely different island. So I didn't feel anything here. My video editor, Brock West from Australia, was here visiting, and he said he was woken up at 4:30 in the morning by some swaying the other day, but I didn't feel it. I was sleeping like a baby. So we're definitely not in the thick of things here. We're watching, like I'm sure a lot of people around the world are watching it unfold on TV.
Have you ever been in an earthquake?
I've been in several, not a big one, thankfully, yet, knock on wood, but there's, yeah, I mean, it's an earthquake-prone country.
Yeah, I understand. I'm sure that you enjoy living in Japan, or at least I assume you like living in Japan, but I wonder if the earthquakes give you pause. You ever sit back and say, I don't know.
Well, yeah, I mean, I feel very comfortable in the spot that we're in specifically in Japan. Japan is a natural disaster prone country in a lot of ways, but we have an inland sea and another island protecting us from tsunamis. We don't have any large earthquakes right where we are, and there's no volcanoes. Godzilla hasn't made an appearance that I've seen in the last decade. So, I mean, I think this spot that I'm in is pretty nicely nestled here.
What about Mothra? Any sign of Mothra?
Yeah, maybe Godzilla scared him away.
Yeah, could be. I've got an article here from Ms. Shedlock. The headline is, EU's refugee dilemma, growing panic on how to change terms of deal with the devil. He says, when you make a deal with the devil, it's certain that the devil will insist you keep your end of the bargain. That's precisely where we are today in regards to the European refugee crisis. German Chancellor Angela Merkel signed off on a deal with the devil, and by that he means Turkey, that would give 80 million Turkish Muslims visa-free entry to the European Union. As part of the deal, Turkey would receive 3 billion euros in aid. In return, Turkey would agree to halt the flow of Syrian refugees pouring into Greece. Well, Turkey did stop the flow of Syrian refugees pouring into Greece, and now Turkey, aka the devil, wants his due. Now, European diplomats are agonizing over their politically perilous promise to grant visa-free travel to 80 million Turks, amid strong warnings from Ankara that the EU migration deal will fold without a positive visa decision by June. Europe couldn't protect its own borders from an invasion by the Syrian refugees. Therefore, it essentially hired Turkish mercenaries to do so. Now those mercenaries want to be paid, and Europe is having second thoughts. I'm wondering, what is Europe's fundamental problem? Could it be that after World War II, Europe is unwilling to fight and therefore unable to defend itself, and that's why it has to make deals with other people to defend Europe? Is that a significant problem? Is that a minor situation?
Well, I mean, it depends on how this is being framed. I mean, if you frame it as warfare, you know, is Europe afraid to fight? I mean, this isn't warfare in any conventional sense. This isn't some army that's lining up against them. It is refugees that are coming across the border. So it's a different thing, and people have to understand it differently than some sort of battle against armies. I mean, that could be one quite easily, but this is something different altogether. I think what this story that you're highlighting here shows, this is the deliberations with Turkey that have been going on, is the fact that really the migrants are being used as a geopolitical weapon. I mean, one way or another, that's what is happening here, and Turkey is trying to wrestle some geopolitical advantage and some money and, you know, access to the EU out of this whole deal, and saying we'll send more people at you. I mean, it's quite obvious right now that these people are being used as a type of weapon. So it isn't a fight in any conventional sense, but clearly there is some sort of battle that's happening right now, geopolitically.
Mm-hmm. Another one here from Zero Hedge, just a headline. Is Deutsche Bank's gold manipulation the main scam or just a sideshow? People have heard that Deutsche Bank is in the news for having reached some sort of a plea bargain over manipulating the prices of gold and silver. I'm not sure if this plea bargain was criminal or just civil, but it must have been serious because Deutsche Bank has promised that they will reveal other banks that were also, they'll expose other banks that were also involved in the manipulation. Somebody put a lot of pressure on them. Is something happening here beyond what we see with just gold and silver manipulation? Are they just the sideshow, or are they the main event?
Well, there is something going on, and it may be that they have to throw a bit of red meat at the pack of rabid wolves that are at their doorstep right now, because there are some major things that are taking place in the bullion markets right now, one of which you may have seen, is China's gold fix. I don't know if you saw this, but China has just launched its own yuan-denominated gold fix as a counter to the London gold fix, which is the London Bullion Market Association's number that they come up with every day for the spot price that is used as the benchmark for pretty much every dealer in the world. Oh, this is the spot price of gold. People might not know that comes from five banks, from market makers that participate in this London gold fix. That's literally what it's called, the gold fix. And every day they run, you know, simulated trades and what have you to come up with the magic number that they're going to use as the spot price. And that's officially only the number for the London Bullion Market Association, but everyone uses it as a benchmark. China has just set up their own benchmark, and they're doing with some Chinese banks. I think a Swiss bank is involved in that mix as well. And they're going to do the same thing. Twice a day, they're going to set a price for gold in yuan. And that was just launched this week, just on Tuesday. So there are some pretty big things going on. And I guess if the London gold fixers want to make sure that they can maintain their hegemony over the bullion markets, maybe they want to, you know, throw a bit of red meat out there and say, look, we've got the bad guys. They've been doing some manipulation, but it's all taken care of now. And now you can trust our benchmark again. So there's some aspect of that going on here. And I don't know if it's going to be effective, because when you think about it, there's 1.2 billion people in the Chinese market. And, you know, I mean, the Indian market is probably going to be wooed over to using the yuan gold fix at some point. So there's 2 billion people, including many of the most rabidly gold-loving people on the planet, in that market, potential market for the yuan-denominated gold fix. I mean, I think there is a shift that's taking place right now, and maybe some of these London bankers are reading the writing on the wall.
Is this shift... is the yuan-based gold fix, is this based on paper gold, as is in the London and COMEX and the rest, that sort of thing, where they're allegedly somewhere between 300 and 500 ounces of paper gold for every 1 ounce of physical gold that can be delivered? Is the Shanghai Gold Exchange working in paper gold? Or are they working only in physical gold and setting the price for physical gold?
Here's how it was reported on Reuters. The Chinese benchmark price is derived from a 1 kilogram contract traded by 18 participants in the Shanghai Gold Exchange, and it was on Tuesday set at 256.92 yuan per gram. The benchmark price will be set twice a day following a few minutes of trading in each session. The London benchmark, quoted in dollars per ounce, is set via twice-daily auction on an electronic platform. So there are 1 kilogram contracts that are being traded here. So it is paper at some level, and that is the way that they're going to determine the price.
Do you think anyone's going to be taking the 1 kilogram, or are they content just to speculate in the paper and maybe make a fast buck if they can and... pocket the paper dollars, paper yuan, whatever. Are they likely to take the paper after the contract is concluded, or are they likely to take the kilogram of gold?
Well, there are certainly people who trade in the paper, and there are some people who will demand physical delivery, but again, it's only a small fraction of the market. And it really depends on who's buying what and from who and for what purpose. It's not just people who are buying, you know, gold jewelry or whatever. I mean, we're talking about people who traded the paper. We're talking about jewelers and retailers. We're talking about different people who are involved for different things. So it really depends on what section of the market you're talking about.
So we're going to have to watch for days, weeks, months before we begin to see how much of the Shanghai Gold Exchange is physical and how much is paper.
Yeah. And I would say we're going to see what this really means in terms of the global balloon market. It might be in terms of years. I mean, I don't think we're going to see all sorts of people shifting over to yuan gold fix right away. Maybe in China there will be adoption of it. But even then, a lot of people will still, I'm sure, use the London gold fix for the time being. And as the market grows, maybe more people will jump on board with the yuan and it'll become the snowball. But for the moment, it's starting off small and humble. But it's part of a shift that is taking place in a lot of different ways. I mean, for example, we've just seen more BRICS cooperation on the idea of a gold exchange between the Bank of China and the Bank of Russia. They want to now create a joint platform that, quote, would unite gold trading by the world's two biggest gold buying countries. So they want to create some sort of gold, a joint gold platform for trading between the two countries. We know that China is still spending large amounts of money on things like capital outflows into gold mining operations around the world. It has just had, in 2015, the busiest year for outbound investment in gold mining since 2011, a huge increase last year from the year before. So we're seeing that there's a lot more money flowing into gold mining operations. We've seen the price for gold rallying this year. It's the best rally in bullion prices since the 1980s right now. There's some big moves that are happening right now. And again, I think that, yeah, the Deutsche Bank thing is just trying to throw a few people under the bus in order to make the bus look a bit better.
Do you think the increases in the price of gold, the money that's being thrown into the gold mines, do you think that's evidence that they anticipate something unpleasant happening to the dollar, or is it just business cycle and unremarkable other than it's no longer going up or no longer going down, but it is now going up, but part of the business cycle more than a judgment on what's going to happen to the dollar in the foreseeable future?
Well, that's an interesting question, and obviously I don't have insight into what they're talking about in their back boardrooms, but that is one of the potential implications of this. And this actually, again, it goes back to something that I think I mentioned a few weeks ago, where Jim Rickards had an interesting article talking about what was happening at the G20 in Shanghai back in February, where he said that basically they've started a new Plaza Accord, a new version of that, where they're going to try to cool down the dollar, which has been soaring in the last couple of years. And we've seen some coordinated actions from the ECB and the Bank of Japan, not easing per se, but rate cutting and things like that, that have the same effect, that is going to start to change that the comparison of those currencies to the U.S. dollar. And I think we are going to see a downward trend in the U.S. dollar. It's been on
meaning inflation,
terror.
Meaning more inflation.
Yes, that
the
will
dollar
be,
will be
the
devalued.
Effect,
it'll take on less value. It's going to suffer inflation or experience inflation as opposed to the deflation that we saw for a period of 18 months or so.
Yes.
Up until recently, the dollar was gaining value and got up and was bumping heads at 100 on the U.S. dollar index. All right, so we're anticipating.
And one would presume that would play out in the commodities markets as well. I mean, part of the reason for the decline in oil prices over the last couple of years has been the surging dollar. So a declining dollar will mean to higher oil prices as well.
But well, one of the other things about it is because the U.S. dollar index is a teeter-totter relationship between the dollar sitting on one end of the teeter-totter and six other fiat currencies sitting on the other end of the teeter-totter. When the dollar inflates, they tend to deflate. And when the dollar inflates, they tend to deflate. Now, this is for me, this is significant because during the 18 months when we saw evidence of deflation, that should have been helping the European and Japanese economies to achieve some degree of inflation that, in theory, should have stimulated their economies. When we say, nope, we're done inflating, we're going into deflation from now on for the dollar, or excuse me, we're done deflating and we're going to inflation the dollar, that should be, in theory, given the teeter-totter relationship, it seems to me that it should be adversarial to the best interests of Japan and best interests of Europe. Does that sound credible to you?
Well, there are a couple of different things that are being measured here. It's not, I mean, obviously for importers and exporters, the price of the currency in other currencies is important. For the person within that economy, it's not directly important. So for people within the economy, it's a question of interest rates determining whether that, you know, you're going to buy a car or a house right now, or you're going to postpone that decision. And on the back of that, then there's economic activity that takes place as a result of those decisions. So there's a domestic angle to this as well as an international angle.
I agree.
And certainly in Japan, there has not been any sort of domestic boost that has come from the last few years. But I have personally have seen the U.S. dollar, Japanese yen relationship has swung wildly in the last few years. And it looks like it's swinging back the other way with the yen gaining on the dollar at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a break for a couple of commercials. James Corbett and I will be back in a moment. I'm Alfred Addisk. This is Financial Survival, and James Corbett is the author and creator of The Corbett Report, CORBETT.com, CorbettReport.com. We'll be back in a second. Please stay tuned.
Herbs announces a brand new formula to help balance blood pressure from head to foot, strengthen your heart muscle, and reduce cholesterol. Now you have a professional strength alternative that works all without fear or worry of serious side effects. Empower yourself. Become independent from the expensive drugs. Call Apothecary Herbs and ask for heart, blood pressure, and cholesterol formula toll-free. 866-229-3663 or online at thepowerherbs.com. Heart, blood pressure, and cholesterol formula is just $24.95 and comes with a money-back guarantee. So get a pencil and write this down. Apothecary Herbs, toll-free, 866-229-3663 or on the web at thepowerherbs.com.
Prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
I'm Alfred Addisk. This is Financial Survival, and I'm here with my guest, James Corbett, author and producer, mastermind behind the Corbett Report, which deals with provides a global perspective on what's happening in the economy, happening in politics. Definitely worth your time. The Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. I've got a headline here from the New York Daily News. And the headline is, Saudi Arabia threatens to pull $750 billion from U.S. economy if Congress allows them to be sued for 9/11 terror attacks. Why has Congress, here we are 15 years after the attacks, we've got a 28-page document that's concealed down in a vault under the Congress that they won't release to the public, but apparently it implicates people important in the Saudi Arabian government in the 9/11 attacks. Now, why has Congress protected the Saudis from lawsuits over 9/11 for the past 15 years?
The short answer is because that would open the floodgates to eroding the idea of sovereign immunity and the ability for other people to sue the United States government for its actions. And once you open that door, Pandora's box, can you imagine the amount of people that are governments and people around the world that would be lining up to sue the U.S. government for its actions? It's a gentleman's agreement. We're not going to let people sue you. You don't let people sue us. We're all going to be nice and gentlemanly about this. And besides, part of this is the fact that there are Saudis that are involved and embedded in the idea of what happened on 9/11 in terms of facilitating various people that were involved in those events and funds and all of that. But there's only one step or two steps of removal from that to the various alphabet soup agencies and how they're intimately involved with the Saudis and the Bush administration and how intimately involved it was with the Saudis and Bandar Bush and all of that. I don't think they want to peel that scab because, it'll start to open some uncomfortable questions. So I think they want to keep this under wraps, but having said that, the declassified 28 pages, the missing 28 pages, has always been, I think, a bit of a something up their sleeve that they've kept in reserve in case they ever need to use it against the Saudis for any reason. You know, keep them in line. It's the stick. Hey, look, we can bring this out at any time. We can get people angry. And boy, have I seen people biting this hook, line, and sinker online, getting angry. Let's bomb those Saudis. You know, nuke them back to oblivion. And can you imagine if they really go ahead with that? I think they could get people on board for an invasion of Saudi Arabia if they wanted to.
It implies that the 28 pages that have been concealed for the last 15 years or thereabouts, it implies that there's explosive information in there. Now, here's another article from the New York Post, and it says, How U.S. Covered Up Saudi Role in 9/11. And it says, in its report on the still-censored 28 pages implicating the Saudi government on 9/11, 60 Minutes last weekend said the Saudi role in the attacks has been soft-pedaled to protect America's delicate alliance with the oil-rich kingdom. So my questions are these. Got a couple of them. Did our government soft-pedal the Saudi role to protect our delicate alliance? Is that what this is all about? Got to maintain a treaty? Is that what this is? And you've already suggested a better alternative is that then to protect themselves. if the American people can sue the Saudis, what's to prevent us from suing our own government? Not just foreigners suing our government. I mean, that's a brilliant answer. But did the government soft pedal the role just to protect our delicate alliance, or was it to protect the petrodollar? Saudis have been at the heart of the petrodollar.
Right. Exactly. I mean, the alliance is the petrodollar in some ways. So that is one aspect of what's going on here. And as I say, the other aspect is that when you're pointing one finger out, three fingers are pointing back to you. So, I mean, look at some of the specifics of this. For example, go to the 60 Minutes piece they just did on the 28 pages, and you'll find one of the fingers they're pointing out there is this character Fahad al-Thumairi, who was a diplomat at the Saudi consulate in L.A., who was apparently intimately involved with two of the alleged hijackers, the 9/11 hijackers, Al-Hazmi and Al-Maidar, since the moment they landed in L.A. in January of 2000. And they're saying, look, you know, here's this Saudi guy, and he's also involved with some other figures, Omar al-Bayoumi, and others who are connected to the Saudi government and were accused of funneling funds for the Saudi princess and things like this. So Here's all these Saudi connections. The things that they're not showing you, for example, are the fact that those same two hijackers, Al-Hazmi and Al-Maidar, the alleged hijackers there, were literally living with an FBI informant called Abdul Sattar Sheikh, who was not only living with them, but he was specifically not, supposedly, according to the official story, not reporting on them or their activities to his FBI handler, Steve Butler, because he didn't think they were important. So he just referred to them in passing a couple times by first name, didn't give any details about it. And lo and behold, wouldn't you know it, these guys get away and end up doing 9/11. It's a ridiculous story in a lot of ways, but it starts to show some of the problems with the official story that we've been told. This actually kind of, I mean, it's been around for 15 years. People have known it's an open secret what the 28 pages is about. But there has been movement in the last few years about this. And one of those movements was Richard Clark, the counterterror czar under Clinton and then Bush, who came out a few years ago to say that he said it was George Tenet himself, director of the CIA, who specifically was keeping information about these two guys and their movements, which the CIA knew about. They knew they were meeting with Al-Qaeda operatives in Malaysia, and they knew that they were on their way into the U.S. They didn't share that with Clark or any of the others. And Clark was saying a few years ago, I have to lay this at the doorstep of Tenet. It couldn't have been less than him, because we were consulting with each other all the time. He would have, should have, could have had every opportunity to tell me about this, and he never did. And his theory that he floated at the time was, well, the CIA was probably trying to run these two guys. They were trying to flip them, trying to see if they could get, some guys inside Al-Qaeda on their side, and it got out of control, and these guys ended up doing 9/11. I mean, I think that's a limited hangout, but at any rate, it goes a lot further than we've been told about 9/11, and it opens up some extremely sticky questions for the CIA, for the FBI, for the NSA, for all of these agencies that I don't think they really want to start opening up. So I don't think they're going to get that far. They just want the intimation that, oh, there were some Saudis involved, let's get angry at Saudi Arabia. And then it's like as I've said before, it's like an attack pit bull. We've got this attack pit bull, and we've got him on a leash. You better hope we don't let go of the leash. And I think that's what it is. It's carrot and stick kind of stuff.
Stop me before I shoot you. That's what it comes down to, in a sense. The 9/11 attacks were deemed so serious and shocking that virtually every American congressman and senator voted for the Patriot Act without even reading it. Patriot Act helped turn this country into a police state and deprived millions of Americans of rights they had previously enjoyed. However, as serious as 9/11 was, we now learn that members of our government helped to conceal the involvement of some Saudi Arabians who may have been close to the Saudi monarchy in relation to that 9/11 attack. U.S. government protected foreign criminals while it robbed Americans of their rights and allowed these criminals to get away with the deaths of several thousand Americans. The reason I bring that up is Article 3, Section 3, Clause 1 of the Constitution declares in part, treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. If people from Saudi Arabia participated in the 9/11 attacks, doesn't that attack constitute evidence of levying war against the several United States? Seems to me that it does. If members of the government, our government, conspired to protect Saudi Arabians who helped execute the 9/11 attacks, aren't those members of the U.S. government giving aid and comfort to the enemies of the several United States? Isn't it apparent that some significant number of highly placed government officers and officials, including George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, and even Barack Obama, and some unknown number of senators, congressmen, and even federal court judges, are liable to be charged with treason, and if found guilty, executed? Do you see treason? Evidence of treason in the 9/11 and concealing the 28 pages. I mean, they robbed us of our rights. They set up a police state while they let the real criminals, or at least some of the real criminals, go.
Yes. I mean, I think you're right about that. And I think that is probably the most likely angle that we would ever have. I don't think it is likely, but it is the most likely angle that we would ever have for achieving any sort of prosecution of what happened on 9/11 and the culpability of various members of the government for it. I think this misses the bigger picture because, again, a lot of this revolves around, for example, support of those two alleged hijackers in Los Angeles and misses all of the stuff surrounding this. I mean, did the Saudis rig a WTC-7 to go down? Did the Saudis direct Able Danger, the Defense Intelligence Agency's coordinated sting in which they had identified Mohammed Atta no less than 13 times before 9/11. Did the Saudis coordinate the drills of hijacked jets flying into government buildings that was taking place on 9/11 as that was actually happening in real life? Did the Saudis direct P-TECH, which was this enterprise architecture software company that was running interoperability drills between the FAA and the Pentagon on the morning of 9/11? Did the Saudis do all of this? I mean, there's so much more to this, but as you say, it's probably the best legal angle that we have into this at this point until that other type of information starts to get investigated. And it leads, I would hope, in a straight line to the question of, well, how about Rumsfeld? How about Cheney? Even just going by the official story and their official account of what officially happened and their official movements on that day, they absolutely 100% did not do anything to protect the country. They were working exactly in the opposite direction. Look at Rumsfeld, for example. On the morning of 9/11, he's the highest ranking civilian in the Defense Department, in control of the U.S. military, only under the commander-in-chief himself, who is out of the picture that day. So he was really in charge of the defense of the nation on that morning. And he goes in after the second strike on the World Trade Center. He goes into a regularly scheduled briefing with his CIA handler and is uncontactable by his staff for that entire half hour while they're chasing all these blips around radar screens, trying to bring these planes, find out what planes are up there, how they can intercept them, what's happening as planes are heading towards Washington. He's just sitting there in a regularly scheduled CIA briefing, and his own staff can't even get in touch with him. That is insanity. And yet, that is the official admitted account of what happened that day, and he's never faced any criticism even, let alone legal ramifications for that. The 9/11 story is so much bigger than this 28 pages, but maybe it's the little wedge that we can use to start opening up some of these questions.
You know, the one thing about it is it's obvious to anyone who looks at it that the buildings were imploded, and it would require weeks or months to install the explosives and wire it without people picking up on what's happening in the building. And it couldn't have been done by Obama bin Laden and his band of merry men. There's no way they could have got in and taken care of it. This had to be a kind of inside job. And who was on the inside remains to be seen. But half the country agrees, I think, with that opinion. Do you?
Sorry, which opinion specifically?
Well, do you agree that the explosives inside the building, it had to be imploded. The explosives would have taken weeks at least to wire the building, maybe more than that. How could it have been? It couldn't have been done by the Muslims. Had
Absolutely.
To be an inside job. Yeah.
100%. I completely agree with that. I do not believe that the WTC-7 did not fall because of an airplane or anything of that sort. It didn't fall because of a failure in Column 18, as NIST wants us to believe, with their video game graphic, basically, that they put out and saying, we can't give you the data for our models because it would jeopardize national security to do that. Mm-hmm. But trust us, that's why WTC-7 fell. It is absolutely a lie, top to bottom. And again, I'm just looking for ways that we can leverage this into I'd love to win in an actual court and see some of these.
Hello, James?
For treason, but unlikely.
Well, we'll watch and see. Who can say? We live in interesting times. Maybe Trump will get in and decide to file a suit for treason. I'm not betting on it, but we do live in interesting times, and nothing seems to be impossible. Thank you, James. I definitely appreciate having you on the program. Look forward to talking to you next week. Want to thank all you folks for listening. I'll be back with Melody tomorrow. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Frank, the producer, and James Corbin. Good night.
All night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? Still, there never seems to be a single penny left for me.